Yeah, hello everybody. Welcome back. Why Bitcoin Podcast, joined here today with DN Comply. DN, is that what you want to be referred to as? DN?
Or Mr. Comply, whatever floats your boat.
Right on, Mr. Comply. Welcome to the show. Happy to have you, man. This is this will be a fun one. Every once in a while I like to throw it on Twitter. Hey, does anybody want to have a chat about Bitcoin? You seemed excited, so we'll see where we take things. Sounds good?
Oh, sounds fantastic. I am sure we will come up with some interesting angles about this bottomless rabbit hole of ours.
Absolutely, man. Okay, well, this is kind of a question I like to start with, just to get the vibe of the person I'm chatting with, which I don't think gets discussed enough. Why do you care at all about Bitcoin in general?
Well, I think that the foundation of any economic system is its money. And if the money is set up in a way that is fundamentally dishonest and exploitative towards most of its users, well, then I think the outcome is going to be predictable. And the outcome is kind of like what the world we are seeing today is like. And it just seems that, you know, when you build anything on a bad foundation, the results are predictably going to go badly. And the more time that passes, the worse the outcome is going to be. So I think that, you know, this, what we're seeing in the United States and the rest of the world today is probably a predictable result of Richard Nixon temporarily taking us off the gold standard and untethering the monetary system to any legitimate form of scarcity. And just as good results compound over time, bad results compound over time. And we've seen 50 years of bad results predictably compounding. And that's what we have today. And I think Bitcoin offers up a remedy to this and radically realigns the economic and monetary system with scarcity. And I think if the monetary system is not based on scarcity, then it's a dishonest system that everybody except for a tiny handful of elite are going to suffer for.
That's fair. What do you see in the world today that's like the biggest concern to you personally? Like, you know, Bitcoiners, we always talk about that. Look at how, and I've been reflecting on this lately, how kind of fucked society is in general. But what is it specifically to you personally that you see that you want fixed or that you think is so fundamentally broken because of fiat? Like, what's a specific example in your own life?
Well, I think it touches on every aspect of your life. It touches on the fact that all the people in my life are, to one extent or another, victimized by a shaky financial system. And even if you're making decent amounts of money, you have to be a borderline professional investor and have like real financial savvy to retain your purchasing power. Like, you know, I have a friend, for example, who's a doctor who makes really good money, but you know, why should she also have to have an enormous amount of financial savvy just to hold on to what she's earning? And you know, I think that same dynamic plays out at the lowest tier of the economic system, fast food workers, et cetera, minimum wages, a tip economy. I think everybody is victimized when the default monetary system is based on a fiat currency that is inflating. I think that it certainly plays out in terms of the wars that governments are able to start and spin up. You know, it certainly plays out in the kinds of media we consume. I mean, this isn't really the place for an extensive analysis, but you and I could, I'm sure, go to the New York Times and go headline by headline and evaluate the slant of the story and the decision to cover that particular story based on factors related to fiat economics. So, I mean, I think everywhere you look, we are all being impacted by the fact that we've got a debt-driven system, a government that has really no hope of repaying its debts unless it increasingly erodes its currencies. Everywhere you look, you just see bad news that arises from having an economic system that's built on a dishonorable foundation.
Yeah, I agree with that for the most part. I do wonder, like, another thing Bitcoiners say a lot is why do people have to have two jobs, you know, your regular job and then an investing job to just keep up with the inflation of the fiat money. But even on a Bitcoin standard, and you can agree or disagree with this, it's still going to be up to the individual to understand how the money works and why it's either going up in value or not. Because I think we're going to get into a point where a lot of people will start, you know, saving in Bitcoin or investing in Bitcoin, but they won't know what they're buying anyways. So we're going to see a lot of people that, you know, you have a regular job, you buy some Bitcoin, a few years pass by, you have more money than you thought you would, and then you just spend it all anyways. So that's one concern that I have, is just like this shift of the situation we're in right now, where so many people are so stuck on living for the moment, not really saving for the future, where it's Bitcoiners that really get it, you know, we're trying to make a better future. But for the most part, people are just wanting to, you know, quote unquote, get rich, make some fucking sick gains and go buy some bullshit. So do you think that's something that Bitcoin fixes, or do you think that's just a individual trait that different people have or don't have? And is that something that separates Bitcoiners from other people?
Well, I think having an inquisitive nature about the world is a relatively rare character trait. And I think, leaving Bitcoin aside, it's just not something I think typical people ask themselves, well, where does our money come from? You just sort of take for granted that whatever the currency is of your native country, you know, that's been around since you were a kid. It's always held some value, and you just always assume that, well, a $20 bill is going to buy me this much stuff. So I think very few people think about money and start asking questions about it that bring us to first principles. But I think that, as your audience no doubt knows, when your unit of account shifts to Bitcoin, your money is no longer being diluted. There's no more. There's only going to be 21 million Bitcoin, and so you know, if you're fortunate enough to have purchased 21 Bitcoin, you own 1/1,000,000th of the supply, and that's never ever going to change, even in the slightest. Your ratio of whatever amount of Bitcoin you own, your ratio of the total 21 million cap supply is never going to change. And so whether you understand that to be the case or not, the truth remains that the bleeding has stopped. You are no longer having your savings being diluted as long as you are storing your wealth within Bitcoin. And I think some people will be able to articulate that reality even better than I just did. Some people will merely have intuition about it, and some people will be clueless about it. But regardless, as long as your money is in Bitcoin, it is no longer being inflated away. And I think that that has all sorts of positive, foreseeable, and unforeseeable outcomes.
Does it make you wonder, though, that, like, understanding Bitcoin, I'm sure, well, I'd be curious to know, like, how you came to your understanding of Bitcoin. Because when I did, and let me know if you kind of feel the same, it just seems so obvious, right? It's like, oh, Bitcoin, this is a better money. I'm going to save in this money because all the other money is shit. It's so obvious. And, like, you would think by now that most of the world would have figured it out. And the fact that they haven't yet, even, you know, 15 years in, it makes me question whether or not some people ever will. So I struggle with this idea of hyper-Bitcoinization and everybody using Bitcoin as their unit account and everybody using Bitcoin as their money. And I'm really more leaning towards the side of most people will just have either custodial Bitcoin controlled by somebody else anyways, so they'll still be slaves to whatever system that they're running on. And then there'll just be a few sovereign individuals that actually can understand what what they want to do with their life and how they want to live it, and they're not controlled by anybody else. So where does your faith in the future of humanity lie? Do you see a bright orange future where it's all beautiful and sunshine and rainbows? And I ask this because that's what I used to think. I just feel like I'm starting to get blackpilled again, where I'm thinking like most people are idiots. So where do you stand on that idea?
Well, I definitely think that most people lack an inquisitive quality. Most people are not aligned with any sort of real integrity. And most people, when you get down to it, are fundamentally NPCs, non-playable characters. And you really can't expect most people to be inquisitive enough to wade into how money is created, credit is extended, and all of that. These are all kind of really relatively, well, I mean, we call them rabbit holes for a reason. It's like as you start going down it, you realize it's an endlessly complicated topic. But, you know, well before we should have a conversation about whether everybody is going to start embracing Bitcoin for what it is, I would say, hey, we're not even at that point. Let's have a conversation about why there's only really one MicroStrategy company out there that is really serious about truly using Bitcoin as a unit of account and using it as its primary treasury asset. I know there's a bunch of miners that do that, but how long is it going to be till one of the S&P 500 companies gets serious about putting even 10% of its treasury to work in Bitcoin? I mean, isn't it remarkable that you would think that you know, the S&P 500 has 500 CEOs, and you'd think that these people are all in the top 1% in terms of being financially savvy, and yet Bitcoin apparently isn't being held by a treasury asset by any of them. Now, I think the nine ETFs that have just been approved is going to make this just a matter of time until we start seeing the dam break, because now any of these companies can just buy the ETF to gain some Bitcoin exposure. They don't have to jump through the incredible strategic and regulatory hurdles that Saylor and his gang had to jump through to enable MicroStrategy to begin holding Bitcoin. So I think it will happen, but before we get into the question of when the average person is going to start hodling Bitcoin, I think the fact that essentially none of corporate America, no college endowments that anybody really knows of, there's really nothing out there in terms of institutions that are yet serious about holding Bitcoin as a reserve asset. And until that happens, I can't even entertain the idea of having a discussion about when are the majority of just regular people going to dive into this.
So do you think it's more important that these major corporations and people like that adopt Bitcoin before your average person on the street? Because yeah, you think that's more important, or you think it's just more likely that it'll happen first? Because go ahead.
I think it's more likely the corporations will go first, just because anybody with huge pools of capital has an extra level of incentive to, when billions of dollars are at stake, there's a lot more brain power going into holding and growing that money than when Joe Sixpack is trying to make the most out of his monthly paycheck.
Well, I'd have to disagree, because that's not what we've seen in Bitcoin thus far, right? Like, the first people that started buying it were Joe Sixpack and just, random people. And wouldn't you say that it's more important that regular Joes, regular people with regular jobs, adopt Bitcoin before the major corporations? Because the corporation, like, put it this way, if you're, I don't know, name a company. Sony, like, say you're Sony and you have a couple billion dollars in your cash account or whatever, are you really that concerned about buying some Bitcoin to hold on to that? You have a hell of a long time until you go bankrupt, quote unquote. Whereas the regular person on the street that's getting poorer and poorer by the minute, this is where I came in. I'm like, I'm getting poorer and poorer and poorer. What the hell is going on? Thank God I found Bitcoin, because I'm like, oh, the money was broken. Whoops, I was saving the wrong thing. So it was easier for me to see it than it is going to be for a corporation that's already doing well for themselves. I think people wake up quicker via pain instead of gain, to make a rhyme there. But like, yeah, I mean, Michael Saylor, even himself, why did he do it? He realized he was sitting on a lot of money or a lot of cash, and it was, he says it's a melting ice cube. So he was concerned that he was going to lose it all. Like, it's more fear driven, saying, oh shit, I'm about to lose everything. I have to do something about this. And I think individuals are going to experience that before corporations do. What do you think?
Well, I mean, you just mentioned Michael Saylor, and I think in his, 11 part, What Is Money series with Breedlove, even though he's a gigantic personal holder of Bitcoin, in his series with Saylor, I believe he talks about the reality facing MicroStrategy and its balance sheet, and how you just see so many companies. I mean, look at Boeing, which used to have just an ironclad balance sheet. They've taken on a couple billion dollars of debt for shareholder buybacks, and now doors are falling off their airplanes. I think there's a really pernicious pull towards trading for major companies to resort to all sorts of financial tricks to go into debt and do these buybacks in an attempt to deliver outsized returns to shareholders. And it's all smoke and mirrors. And I think Saylor articulates that, there's just when you have $1 billion on your balance sheet, it's just getting diluted at realistically 5 or 10% a year compounding. And unless you are a financial genius, really your only way to stop the bleeding is to move into an asset that is truly finite and will no longer get inflated away. So I think, he articulates this far better than I ever could. But, my sympathies are certainly, and my orientation is certainly with getting individuals into Bitcoin. I'm just saying that companies that have tens of millions, hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars on their balance sheets, they not only have a much greater incentive to adopt to switch their unit of account to Bitcoin, they also, in all likelihood, have the CEOs and CFOs and the expertise to really have people on staff who understand Bitcoin and the advantages much greater than the average person. But in no way am I belittling the importance of orange pilling individuals. In fact, I spend a great deal of my time trying to do that and virtually none of my time trying to orange pill corporations. So anyway, I hope that's responsive. I don't think we have much of a difference of opinion here. I think we may be wording our thoughts a little differently, but I don't see a fundamental difference of opinion here between your thoughts and mine on this topic.
Yeah, absolutely. I can agree with that. I was just kind of trying to pick your brain there and see. It's just weird, right? It's like Bitcoin's going to be for anybody that's smart enough to realize that fiat is melting away. So it'll be curious to see who comes first. It seems like it's more small time individuals than it is corporations, but I guess this next cycle will prove to be, it'll go one way or the other. We're going to see what happens for sure. hopefully more fucking people wake up, man. I don't know. We'll see. That's what I wanted to ask you. What did you do? What was your job or your, and oh yeah, I meant to tell you, like, if I haven't asked any questions that are too personal or whatever, you can just not answer them. But I'm curious what you did before Bitcoin. What was your job? What was your career? Or what was your life like before Bitcoin?
Well, I started out of college as a technical writer, and there's I really have devoted most of my time to activism that changes the world in ways that I think it needs to be changed. And so I've done a lot of writing, and I think one of my primary skills has always been, and this started out with me being a technical writer, but one of my primary skills has been just to look at something that is relatively complicated and then to explain it in simple terms. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 20 or 30 years in different forms. And then I got into Bitcoin in 2015. And I would say like a year and a half ago, and I did nothing within Bitcoin. I orange-pilled a few people, but I was not active in any way. But starting about 18 months ago, I realized that I didn't have a resource that I could wholeheartedly recommend to newbies. You know, the question is, well, you know, if you're trying to talk about Bitcoin and get somebody interested in it, certainly at the top of your mind, there's going to be some YouTube video or some podcast episode or some article that you should refer them to. And I think for a lot of time, you know, my top resource that I'd recommend was the bullish case for Bitcoin. But that didn't quite cover things. It didn't cover some key things that I thought ought to be covered. And it, as time went on, it became a little less cutting edge and current. So finally, about a year and a half ago, I decided, well, I'm going to roll my own. And I felt like at that point I had enough knowledge about Bitcoin that I could really do a clear, sharp introduction to it. But as somebody who's done most major types of writing, be it fiction, history, sort of pedantic writing, whatever, I've done a variety of I've done research oriented writing, I've done academic writing, I've done just about every major type of writing you could think of. There is something unique to writing introductory texts that make it an especially time-consuming form of writing. And so I forget how many words my Basics of Bitcoin piece is. I think it's around 8,000 words. But the point is I could, if I needed to, write 8,000 words in just a few days and they'd be halfway decent. I think when I'm normally working hard on something, I could write 8 or 10,000 words in a week. But this essay took me 6 weeks to write, which means that it took me approximately six times longer per word than the average piece of writing I'm working on. And, Satoshi himself, herself, itself, even Satoshi complained about the difficulty of introducing Bitcoin to people because he said, well, there's nothing to compare it to. And I would say if somebody as once in a generation as brilliant as Satoshi had trouble introducing it to people, there's just something intrinsic to it that makes it extraordinarily difficult to introduce to newbies. And that's a big part of why I think the uptake rate of people going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole isn't what we need it to be. So I wanted to do something about that. And I think I was pretty successful in writing something that people have found helpful. I've been really encouraged by the fact that out of the blue, people appeared and translated it into French and Italian and Spanish, and hopefully more languages to come. So, I mean, that's been very encouraging to see. So that's that kind of gets into my, you asked me about my background, and yeah, my background was in writing and a bit in teaching. And I just felt like I had some skills to bring to the table that could be really useful to the hyper Bitcoinization and the orange pill world that we all want to see. So I finally broke down a year and a half ago and took the time and created this piece.
That's awesome, man. How's the feedback been on the book you wrote? I ask because, like, it's sort of a similar reason why I started my show like I did. It's just I want something for people to listen to dive in, that are diving into Bitcoin to kind of get a... I started off thinking I wanted to make a introductory course and kind of explain what it is and why it's important. But as the show's gone on, I've realized I don't have, like, I'll talk to people and tell them, oh yeah, I do a podcast about Bitcoin. Like, oh, send me an episode. I'm like, fuck. Like, I don't have any episode to send to a new person. They're all like this, where it's just like, obviously Bitcoin is. So where did you, without giving your entire book away, where did you start? Like, what's page one of Introduction to Bitcoin? Like, well, how did you do it?
I think the thing I focused on that was that is unique to my essay. And by the way, this essay is available for free on my website, dncomply.com. And the one approach that I took that I've never seen anyone take within Bitcoin is that I kind of came up with about 20 of the most common quotes that you will hear again and again and again about Bitcoin, and kind of wove those quotes into the piece with descriptions about why those quotes were, you know, were as widely repeated as they've become. So the very first quote in my piece, we've all heard it: everybody buys Bitcoin at the price they deserve. And then a little later on, or a few paragraphs later, I talk about taking the orange pill. And, you know, later on, you know, a few paragraphs after that, I talk about hodling and hodlers and where that word came from. And I, you know, when you start introducing these major concepts, like hodling, taking the orange pill, low time preference, the number go up technology, you know, just by introducing these cute neologisms surrounding Bitcoin, you're shining the light on different aspects of this technology that make it so appealing. So I think structuring my essay where it points to the 20 or so top phrases and quotes within Bitcoin was a really nice way to kind of give people the full spectrum of why it is that Bitcoin offers something that alternate forms of money don't, and why it's important to stop being a no-coiner, no-coiner being yet another phrase that I included in the essay. So that's kind of the route I took to weaving together this essay. And I think it was a unique way of doing things, and it simultaneously guaranteed that I would get into kind of all the major points surrounding Bitcoin so that it could be cohesively understood.
Dude, that's such a good idea. I'm going to steal that idea and write my own. That makes so much sense. It's so easy. That was one of the things when I got into Bitcoin, learning about, like, I knew nothing of money or finance or anything, so I had to learn all these words and learning all the Bitcoiners speak too. We basically have our own language, right? You're absolutely sure. Right. So just breaking down those ideas, and a lot of Bitcoiners will say like, you know, you probably have not your keys, not your coins in there, things like that. And you just, you just break it down to somebody that knows nothing. What a great idea. Damn, I wish I thought of that. Well done.
Well, you know, we all have our part to play, but I would say that, you know, there are vast numbers. I find that I'm incompetent at nearly everything. Just explaining things is one of the two or three things that I'm good at. You know, but I mean, there's a reason I don't speak Japanese. There's a reason I don't fly a plane. There's a reason I've never taken up sailing. And that reason is that I'm incompetent, and I will crash that plane. But, you know, so I do the things that I'm good at. And it turns out that I believe that most people have no more talent when it comes to explaining complicated things than they do in understanding quantum mechanics. But we're all good at something. But one thing we all have is we have a certain amount of social capital. There are people in your life who will listen to you. If only it's, you know, perhaps it's only your parents or your son or whatever, but there are people who will listen to you. I mean, there's people who, just because you went to elementary school together, they're interested in you. They're interested in what you have to say. And I really strongly believe that most Bitcoiners don't have the you know, the depth of understanding or the command of language sufficient to properly explain the topic. But what they can do is use their social capital with family and friends and say, look at this, this is one of the most important technologies of our lifetimes, maybe the most important topic, and the window is closing on learning it before the masses arrive and we have $1 million Bitcoin. Let me tell you that the most important thing you could do with your time right now is to stop whatever the hell you're doing and put 10 hours into studying Bitcoin. And I think the best place to go and study it, well, I would hope that you'd say, well, go and read this essay that I've written. But whatever it is, whatever we should all have a default recommendation for an introductory piece. And not put it on ourselves to try to explain this to people. Your job is to just get somebody sufficiently interested that they're willing to put in their first hour to learning and to tell them, hey, this needs at least 10 or 20 hours before you even start to get it. But it is of crucial importance that you get started. And here's where I think you should start.
Do you remember what your introductory piece was what was the first thing you read or watched or saw on Bitcoin? Do you remember what it was?
Yeah. Now, I think that I was uniquely prone to understanding Bitcoin very quickly because I had... I was around 50 years old when I got orange pilled, and it just so happens that in high school I had studied some economics, and this was during the Reagan era, and I took a semester of macroeconomics in college. But I also had read, you know, Marx and Smith and, you know, basic economics. So I knew my way around the basics of our modern financial system. So I knew those things. I knew that I'd watched the United States national debt spiral to increasingly insane levels over 30 years with one worried eye always on the national debt clock. So I had those kinds of things. Also in high school, I was just really, you know, I had a Commodore 64 that I bought with my lawn mowing money and did a little bit of, you know, basic programming there. Later on, I got into HyperCard and scripting and stuff like that. So I was never like a real programmer, but I knew enough about, you know, I'd taken Pascal class and Fortran class and that kind of stuff. I'd done enough programming, like really high level programming, that I knew what, you know, basic scripting could accomplish. I also knew about PGP and the emergence of public and private key encryption and how that was invented, and, you know, read a book about that in the late 90s. So when you have a rough understanding about fiat economics, when you have a rough understanding of scarcity and how various ways it can be measured, when you have a rough understanding about programming and cryptography, what happened to me was I brought all these things to all these things were kind of banging around in my brain, and one day, at the very end of 2014, I threw on a Joe Rogan podcast, and it so happened he was interviewing Andreas Antonopoulos, who, and this was like right after the very first bull market in Bitcoin. And I think, you know, for me, because I had experience in a high level understanding of all the things I just talked about, when I started listening to Andreas, the pieces of the puzzle fit together immediately. And after this 2-hour interview, I was more or less convinced that I would put my life savings, which weren't a heck of a lot, but at the time, Bitcoin was going for around $300 a coin. So a little money went a long way. I was pretty sure I would put my life savings into Bitcoin. So I, by the end of the Joe Rogan episode, and after another few days of study, I wasn't just pretty sure. I was, opening up a Coinbase account to make that happen. So, in January of 2015, I made a bunch of Coinbase purchases and purchased my Bitcoin, and in all that time, I have never sold a Satoshi. I have only acquired more Sats over the years since, not just straight Bitcoin, but I had an IRA, so I had no way to conveniently access Bitcoin. But as soon as the MicroStrategy adopted Bitcoin in its treasury, I started buying MicroStrategy shares with my IRA, have gotten Bitcoin exposure in other ways too. So I have a bunch of piles of Bitcoin from various sources, most of it, of course, being coins that I custody directly.
That's cool, man. Yeah, Andreas was an all-star. Well, still is. And he just kind of went down a couple weird paths, but I think he's starting to come back around. That was a good episode. I appreciate Andreas Antonopoulos, man. He's got a good way of explaining things. This print, your story brings me back to the idea that, like, are we as Bitcoiners giving too much credit to, like, I kind of feel the same way. You know, you look at your whole life and you say, oh, I was always skeptical of the system. I didn't really understand what was going on, or I figured out how the Federal Reserve worked. And so when you find Bitcoin, it's like an easy aha click moment. You get it because you've done all that background research or understanding, wherein most people, I don't think a lot of people are interested in that shit. So do you think, here's a controversial question for you. Do you think we even need introductory things for Bitcoin, or do we just have to wait for everybody to just get fucking wrecked by fiat in order to switch over? Like, how many people, or I'm not trying to sound like a dick here. Hold on. Let me try and phrase this correctly. How's the feedback been on your book? Has anybody come up to you and been like, oh, I had no idea about any of these things, and now I'm becoming a Bitcoiner. Has that happened yet? Because it has, again, it hasn't happened to me. No, nobody's listening to my show and changing shit. I've talked to so many fucking people like, here, watch this video, check out this book, read this article. There's so many people I'm talking to that I'm like, just, learn something, fuck. And they just don't. It's so frustrating. So I'm asking for a white pill here. Tell me something good. Tell me you've switched some people's minds.
Oh yeah, I've definitely, absolutely, positively shifted people's minds. And just in the past week, I have gotten three different people to purchase a total amount of roughly one Bitcoin between them. So I've inspired three different people to each acquire, what in the future is going to be regarded as obscenely large amounts of Bitcoin. And this is just something I've accomplished in the last week. But I want to tell you that, it is fundamentally the nature of any kind of activism or advocacy, including Bitcoin, that you're never going to know a tenth of what you truly accomplish. It's just really rare for people to get back to you and say, hey, you were the one. Maybe in this conversation, like I talked about the Breedlove Sailor series, and maybe just as a result of this conversation, we have a listener out there who's going to just chance to notice that series tomorrow and they're going to halfway remember what I said today. And then they're going to go and listen to that series and they'll forget all about you and me and the things that we said. But the fact is that listening to our conversation got them to listen to the Breedlove Sailor series, go further down the rabbit hole. So, you know, they're never going to report back to us and let them know that this fragment of this conversation was so pivotal in their lives. They won't even know it themselves. But it is a real butterfly effect that I think anybody who's just being listened to, even if it's only by, you know, even if this podcast only had a dozen people listening to them, each of those people are flapping their wings in various ways and having effects that they won't know about themselves. So, you know, I think very likely this conversation we're having is not going to reach not just your audience, but the people that they talk to in a multitude of ways. And none of this will ever get back to us, but it's still crucial stuff. And I know that, like, we are all gods in terms of making vast differences in the world. We just don't know it. But I know that we do.
That's cool, man. I like that perspective. That's good shit. I used to record a podcast every week, and I've kind of gone back to just doing one a month. And I think with that, I just have lost a lot of faith in humanity. So thanks for bringing me back. I like the positive outlook. I think it's good. You know, Bitcoin is going to solve a lot of problems. We just have to remember it's just going to be a lot slower than we thought. Hey, so you've been around since 2015. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the progress of Bitcoin adoption, Bitcoin in general, since being here? I guess it's, you know, next year it'll be your 10 year anniversary. Is it where you thought it'd be? Is it further? Is it not as far? How do you feel about the development of Bitcoin since you've been around?
Well, you know, when I started, you know, Bitcoin, I mean, my first year of holding Bitcoin, my cost basis was $270 a coin, and the price of Bitcoin promptly dropped to about $230, and I was underwater by about $40 a coin for an entire year, but I didn't give a shit because I knew what I had, and I knew it was either going to go to zero or it was going to go nuts, and obviously, $1,000 a coin was table stakes, but in terms of where I thought it could go, I thought at least it's going to, you know, I could very easily foresee the day where one Bitcoin would be worth more than an ounce of gold. And that happened in a year or two. And then, you know, by that point, maybe it's going to hit 10,000. That doesn't seem too unreasonable. Maybe it could get there. And then it hits 10,000. Then, like, well, you know, people like Max Keiser are saying 100,000. That sounded insane when Bitcoin was, you know, $2,000 or $3,000, but it sure doesn't sound insane anymore. It sounds like a foregone conclusion that unless something destroys Bitcoin, it's going to be up to 100 grand before too long. I mean, I think we're rapidly moving into a world where, I mean, Samson Mao or Samson Moe, M-O-W? Anyway, Samson has been,
I think.
Yeah. Samson Mao has been saying, you know, that he thinks we're going to get $1 million Bitcoin sooner than anybody wants. And I think his arguments are actually really, really strong. I think that, once some major corporate treasuries start, you know, like, you got to ask, you know, what's Tim Cook even doing? I mean, Apple is a technology company. How the hell do they not own Bitcoin? And, you know, once the Apples and Microsofts of the world realize that they should be putting a percentage of their treasuries into Bitcoin, you're going to see like this wave of FOMO that we've never seen before. And it's not going to just drag along the corporations. It's going to drag along every institutional and private holder of money. And I think we're on the brink of Bitcoin surpassing anyone's expectations. And like Samson, I really I mean, you were just saying that maybe this is going to take a long time. My response to you is, if only it's going to take a long time. Gosh, I think the longer it takes, the better it would be. But I'm afraid it's going to happen sooner rather than later. And I agree wholeheartedly with Samson that that is probably not a good thing. I think the more years that can go by before we've got $1 million Bitcoin, the better. I would much rather see it take 10 years than 18 months.
Well, yeah, like it must be. See, I came in at the end of 2020. So I've been, I look back at guys that are around buying coins at $200 like yourself, or $10 like, you know, the class before you, or, and you just wonder, $10,000 was moon math. And now it's like, imagine if it went to $10,000, Bitcoin would be fucking dead. It's so weird. So it's so hard to say what's going to happen with the price. We just, I don't know. It could go anywhere. But what about the just overall public sort of idea about Bitcoin? Have you seen a shift in that at all? Because like when you go, I wonder, you know, because like I feel like I'm the only Bitcoiner in town, and I go around and when I go to the barber shop or the fucking grocery store, I'll be that asshole being like, hey, do you accept Bitcoin? You know, I do that every once in a while, even though you know they're gonna say no, but you feel like you're the only one. Did you ever do that? And do you feel like there's more, obviously there is more Bitcoiners now than there was when you started, but does it feel like there's more to you, or does it still feel like a very niche group of people?
Well, I think that the approval of the 9 ETFs has legitimized Bitcoin in a way that no amount of personal advocacy ever could. I mean, you know, now anybody, any boomer with a substantial wad knows that Bitcoin is an emerging asset class and that they can acquire exposure to Bitcoin just as easily as they can buy shares of Apple Computer. And so it is, if it's not mainstream now, it's just a matter of weeks, really, until any reasonable person would put it, would call it mainstream. The Charlie Munkers of the world are dying off, and Bitcoin is no longer being considered as rat poison. It's being considered as a mainstream asset that it's going to be the fiduciary responsibility of any money manager to allocate a portion, at least a portion of their clients' assets to Bitcoin, because you know that's what money managers do. They fill the basket with every major investment class so that you have true diversification. And so I would say, you know, fear not. I've seen so much change in people's thinking over the last 7 or 8 years. And don't get too caught up on the people you meet in your own town. And yeah, at this point, most people still don't have any basic understanding of Bitcoin, but you care enough to be doing this podcast. I guarantee you there's somebody listening in Gainesville, Florida, or Mobile, Alabama, or, you know, Exeter, New Hampshire, some sort of out of the way place that you wouldn't think there's any Bitcoiners there, but they're listening right now to this podcast, and there's wisdom that's being dropped by the shows you do that are orange pilling people slowly but surely and moving Bitcoin more and more into the mainstream. I mean, we're all doing, if you care enough to be doing a podcast or be a guest on podcast or whatever it is you're doing for Bitcoin, it is reaching people. It's never going to reach as many people as you'd hope, but the important thing is that you do something, and you just know that there are everything you do bears fruit in the world, and sometimes most of the time you don't even see it. But the important thing is to just do your best and not have any care about any particular outcome. Just keep doing, keep following your heart, keep following your passion, and it creates the kind of world you want to see.
Good white pills, man. Appreciate that. Absolutely. Okay. One more question for you that I don't think it's asked enough in the Bitcoin scene. Do you have anything personally to you that you think could affect Bitcoin negatively? Is there any way you see Bitcoin failing or just, going away? What would be the cause, or are you just completely convinced that this thing is inevitable and there's nothing that can stop it? Where do you stand on that? Do you have any concerns?
I'll read you a sentence or two from my essay, because I have given that thought. So quoting here, my intuition, which like everything else here should not be taken as financial advice, is that Bitcoin is about 30% likely to fail. Failure here would mean it breaks in some way, rendering all Bitcoin worthless. But if Bitcoin doesn't break, I think it will become a dominant worldwide store of wealth, and the majority of people will convert some of their assets to Bitcoin. This would be the start of what Bitcoin enthusiasts called hyper Bitcoinization. So that's how I introduced that term in the essay. But I have to say that I was being very conservative on the high side by saying that Bitcoin had a 30% chance of breaking. And I wrote this essay about a year ago. So I think every year that goes by, that percentage drops somewhat because of the Lindy effect, yet another concept I mentioned in the essay. But how could Bitcoin break? I don't know. But I guarantee you there's people much smarter than you and me who are working on breaking it. And so far, after 15 years, it still hasn't broken. So we should have some level of confidence that there's something really impressively robust about the technology that makes it super hard to kill. But I absolutely don't think, there's Bitcoiners who say, oh, we've passed the event horizon, its chances of failure are zero. And I think that's nonsense. I think that, just to give you an illustration, I was listening to a core developer a few weeks ago, a Bitcoin core developer, and she was saying how one reason they don't have more translations of their distribution so that more people could be running a node and so forth is that every translation carries the possibility that that you're going to have a corrupt translator deliberately screw up the translation in an attempt to introduce a vulnerability in those nodes. So, that's the kind of sick shit that we have to be thinking about. I think you do a profound disservice to Bitcoin if you view its success and its resistance to attack as impregnable. There is always going to be risk, but I think the risk is relatively small. And as Vijay Boyapati puts it, it is the ultimate asymmetric bet. I think even against the 30, if my 30% failure figure is likely, or if is accurate, and most people's predictions of a 10x gain are also accurate, that is a classic asymmetric bet. Who wouldn't take a bet where 70% of the time you 10x your bet? So that's my response to your questions about the likelihood of Bitcoin failing. As usual, I see things in a nuanced and not very certain way. But that's life.
Cool, man. Yeah, 30% seems obnoxiously high to me. I put it a lot lower than that.
But I think if I'm giving people advice about the likelihood of something failing, I want to be obnoxiously high.
Sure.
That's a deliberate, I think it's very likely significantly lower than that. But if you're making decisions that could impact your kids' ability to go to college, I want you to err on the side of caution. And in this sense, that means setting the chances of failure perhaps higher than I think they actually are. That's what conservatism is all about, at least rational conservatism.
Right on, man. Okay, yeah, that's fair. I like that idea. Is there anything on the top of your mind you want to talk about or get off your chest that we didn't touch on?
Nah, I think I would just say, hey, to anybody listening to this, think about whatever the hell it is in life that you're good at, or the people that you know who are likely to listen to you and carry some weight in the world. You know, think about how you might orange pill them. I mean, we each bring something unique to the table. I mean, I think most people are really terrible at most things and really good at a few things, and you just got to find what you're good at and what you're passionate about and set it to use. And there is, if what you care about is helping the world stamp out fiat currency and have a future of hyper Bitcoinization, then you can absolutely contribute in some way, even if it's just at the point getting in your first 10 or 100 or 1,000 of hours of study. Maybe, it took me more than 6 years in Bitcoin before I lifted a finger to advocate for it in a real way. I did orange pill some people along the way, but I didn't do anything, you know, public. I didn't write this essay for more than 6 years because I was busy just immersing myself and learning as much as I could. And I don't think I could have written I absolutely couldn't have written a piece like this after my first 3 years as a Bitcoiner. I would not have had the sufficiency of knowledge. So, you know, I think probably many people listening to this are either new to Bitcoin or only a couple of years in. And, you know, if you don't yet see ways to contribute, well, maybe your contribution for now is to just keep learning, and eventually you're going to get to the point where you see a way to contribute in a really powerful way.
Oh yeah, man, that's a great message to send out. I appreciate that. Let people give us the link for where to find your book and shill your Twitter handle. Anything else you want to let people know where to find you and learn more about what you're doing?
Okay. Yeah. Again, the essay is free. And it's on my website, and that's D as in do, N as in not comply, dncomply.com. And the essay is there. I've done some podcasts, and there's links to my podcast. I'll be putting this podcast up on it. I'd love to appear on some more podcasts. If any listeners have a favorite they could recommend me for. I just hope we all keep on keeping on, as Steve Miller would put it.
Hell yeah, man. Good shit. All right, listeners, everybody there, thanks for tuning in once again. DN Comply, dude. I fucking love talking to Bitcoiners. You made me feel good. I like the positivity. I need that every once in a while. The world is
dark. Oh, it
was a
blast. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Stay positive. Stay happy and upbeat. That's good shit. We need that, dude. I still listen to podcasts all the time, and I've stopped listening to some Bitcoin podcasts because there's so much fucking doom and gloom going on about how shitty everything is, which is just like, I don't even need to hear this anymore. Just tell me the glory that is Bitcoin and what it's going to bring and how great it is, instead of all the bullshit all the time. It's nice to hear the positive side of things. So I appreciate that you're doing that. Appreciate that you're sticking to that. If you listen this far and you appreciate the show, be sure to follow DN Comply on Twitter. Go check out his page. And also share this show around if you got any value out of it. That's the best way to help us out. Just share it. And also consider listening on Fountain. If you do that on Fountain, you can stream a sats. You can send boostergrams. And you can earn your own sats, which is pretty awesome. With that, thanks as always. We'll be back soon. And remember, as always, just buy as much Bitcoin as you can before the end of the world. Until next time. Peace.